Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. In the beginning, there was the word, and that word was accommodation. And the people were like, can you use it in a sentence? And God was like, accommodation. I've provided accommodation for you with this planet. And the people were like, A-C-O. And God was like, nope. And people were like, okay, A-C-C-O-M-O. And God was like, wrong. And people were like, come on, God, why make it so hard to spell Jesus Christ? And God was like, that's a good name for a boy. And Chardonnay if it's a girl. And people were like, A-C-C-O-M-M-A. And God was like, fooled you again. And people were like, it's a stupid way to spell anyway. And God was like, who wants a smiting? And people were like, no, God. And God was like, what did you say? And people were like, no, God. And God was like, yeah, I thought so. Now, some of you can only eat fish on Friday, and some of you need to give me your foreskins. And people were like, which is which? And God was like, schism time! And that sort of behaviour is basically why there are so many atheists in the world. And alongside me is the mortal sin to my immortal goody two-shoes, Ben Vandevel.
Hello. I tried to think of something biblical to say. How do you say hello in biblical? Shalom?
Well, that's just sort of Jewish, but...
Like, firstly, shalom is very much the American pronunciation.
Excuse me.
Shalom. Look at you, the Catholic, trying to fit in. I guess just put up a hand just going, that's incorrect. Like, I'm going to introduce you in a minute because I'm well aware that as the better Jew on the podcast, you're going to be correcting every third sentence I say. Now, obviously this week we're talking about the Old Testament, something which I am reasonably well-versed in. How well-versed in it are you, Barry?
We did the, like, ladybird-friendly versions of the stories. We did, like, Garden of Eden, Snake a Bit Nasty. We did Noah's Ark, did Samson and Delilah, did David and Goliath, and then that's kind of basically it until you get to Jesus.
Okay, so you basically did the West End musical version.
Yeah. We did the, like... We did what Hollywood would do to someone with a really gritty life story. We cut out all of the really dark bits so that we could make it less than a 12 rating and sell it to China.
You're right. There's a lot of fireworks and pyrotechnics and blood, but there's also a lot of admin and architectural detail.
Yes.
So when I did my... was bar mitzvahed age 13, as is tradition, in Orthodox synagogues and communities, you're meant to sing your portion of the law, and my portion of the law was the biggest one that you do. And you think, oh cool, a really big bit, I can sort of really get into the story of it and the learning of it. No, it's just what the different sacrifices are on the temple done child of Israel by child of Israel. So there's the 12 tribes of Israel, and it's basically tribe number one has this, and this. Tribe two has this, and this. For my bar mitzvah, I essentially sung a kosher tasting menu 12 times.
That's amazing. I would love that if you did that in sort of, you know, secular settings or like non-Jewish settings as well, where you just sing a section of the law. And so you have people in the UK singing, you know, the Counterterrorism and Sentencing Bill. You know, be it enacted by the Queen's Most Excellent Majesty, by and with the advice and consent of the Lord Spiritual and Temporal and Commons in this present Parliament assembled and by the authority of the same as follows. Everybody, join in! Part one, yeah. Sentencing of terrorists and certain other offenders.
Just so you know, guys, Barry didn't just Google that. He can just sing any part of the law.
That's my karaoke line.
That's your go-to.
You know that, like, any, like, Jewish kid who's going through a bit of a goth phase would be like, I'm going to sing the Riot Act.
Yeah.
Right, we should introduce this week's guest, having already referenced her but kept her quiet, as is Orthodox tradition. Our guest this week is an award-winning stand-up comedian, writer and director, and the only practicing Orthodox Jewish woman on the mainstream UK comedy circuit. So of course it's only right that we wish her the most Shana of Tovas, the most Yom of Kippurs, and the most Simchatic of Torahs. She is co-host of Chat Show podcast Jew Talk talking to me, and resident MC of Comedy Upstairs at the Adam and Eve, a long-established new material night for professional comics. And also, it just occurred to me, super on brand for a very Orthodox Jew. She's a skilled improviser and singer, and is part of the rotating lineup for popular shows, including This Is Your Trial and the Edinburgh cult hit musical comedy, The Complete History of Pop Music in an Hour. She would like to be part of the static lineup, but they insist she does the 360 on every single performance. Amongst the Jewish community, she is a headliner, playing many main stages at festivals all over the country and abroad. She's performed to thousands each winter across packed gigs at the prestigious Limud Festival, and this year performed at their satellite event in Helsinki. Who knew, Barry, that there were Finnish Jews? I always thought that was just top of the ISIS to-do list. She is well known as the compere of the UK's largest annual Jewish event, Hanukkah in the Square, a yearly celebration in Trafalgar Square during which Nelson's Column is transformed into an enormous cylindrical latke and the lions are coated in donut batter. We're taking over, lads. Bit by bit, we're taking over. She's been described as a star to behold by the Jewish Chronicle, intelligent and perceptive by The List, and at last, a proper one by Barry. Please welcome to the show the halachically hilarious Rachel Krieger.
And I'm going to say himeini, because that means hello in a biblical way. Behold, here I am.
Wow.
Oh, you bless you. You were sat on that through all of our show. And that's also on brand, as it's the name of your latest show.
It was my last show that is currently meant to be on tour, but there's been a little pandemic and it stopped everything. So this is the first time I've been able to say Hineini in about 6 months.
You're very welcome. It does feel a little bit like Hashem basically went a bit early with an immersive Passover experience. Just he pressed the button in February and was like, guys, I don't know how to turn it off. Gabriel, quick.
Oh, wow. Are we just living through like a series of plagues right now? Is that what it is?
We've sort of stopped. First one. I mean, I'm just like, I'm quite excited for the Locusts, because at least then David Attenborough will have something nice to say about it.
Yeah, he will. And also, you know, good protein.
Excellent protein.
I didn't
and summer
know.
Yes, they are. How can you is it now with locusts, the ones that are kosher, is it's locusts with cloven hooves and four stomachs, right?
It's about the colours, but I mean, this might come as a shock to you because I'm from Essex and now I live in North London. I've not really eaten many locusts, kosher or otherwise, but I believe it is about what colour they are. I can Google it for you.
It's all right. Is it basically if the locust accessorises with the rabbi's wife's handbag, then it's kosher? We always ask our guests on this show, Rachel, what are they worst at in the world? So whilst you excel at performing, what is it that you are really bad at?
I'm a terrible sleeper. I am a really terrible sleeper, and I've been a bad sleeper pretty much for always. And how it impacts on me is really compounded by the fact that my husband can lie down, close his eyes and go to sleep. Like, nothing's made me feel more murderous, I'll be honest, than when I'm wide awake at like 3 o'clock in the morning and he comes up from, he works online, as we all do at the moment, and he often deals with people in other countries, so he has meetings at random times. And he could come up to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and I'll be lying there awake, hating everything, and he'll say, good night, literally lie down and go to sleep. I don't think I did that even as a baby. Maybe it's a baby. Maybe they drugged me. I don't know. But yeah, terrible sleeper. And I've tried everything. Whatever you suggest, I've tried it, taking all the devices out of the room. And I've tried lavender oil and going to bed early, going to bed late, changing my routine and whatever, hot baths, whatever you want. Hot milk even. Can't sleep. Terrible sleeper.
I am. I'm quite similar. My husband is able to fall asleep in no time at all, and I can be lying there for like 3-4 hours not falling. I'm just sort of staring at the ceiling, and I have recently done one of those meditation, you know, this isn't about sleep but it's going to help you sleep meditation things over the course of a month, and it had a habit. It would get you to do like these breathing meditation body exercise, and then it'd go, and while you're there, let's just think about what we have in the room, and it'll give you like the advice about, you know, taking the devices out, or you making sure that, you know, don't drink alcohol or take drugs before bed. And then at the start of the next one, it would go, now you might remember last time we were discussing not having device in the room. It's like, we weren't discussing anything, you were chatting at me and I was sitting in my room.
But I've also tried, Barry, one of those like meditation app things. And one of the things I said was to try and you were supposed to picture yourself in all these different, very relaxing environments. And one of them, like the main one it seemed to be quite excited about, was that you're a leaf on a tree and you're blowing in the breeze. And then you detach from the tree, which is actually quite distressing. And then you fall into the water and you're kind of, the water is carrying you in this very watery way. And in my head, I was a holly leaf. And I was catching on everything. And it was really and I don't know if there are any therapists listening. I mean, that is a gift. That's your next paper right there, isn't it? But yeah, it didn't work for me.
Ben, I've known you a long time. You've long claimed that Jews are neurotic people, and I've long disagreed with you, but I'm slowly coming around to your way of thinking.
When I pitched this to you, I knew you'd be up for it, but character felt like it might have been a bit of a disrespectful word, but I couldn't think of the right word, because it is a story.
World's worst Old Testament plot line.
I mean, I would sort of self-interpret as biblical hero, the worst biblical hero. Because obviously, like Barry, you got the Ladybird book of Bible, and we sort of had the Stephen King version in my very
ultra. I will say this, though, that the difference between God and Stephen King is that God does know how to write endings. I mean, trippy endings, but he knows how to write a good ending.
But I went for the term biblical hero, like who's the worst biblical hero, because in my school, everyone was a hero, even in a way the villains, because they all had something to teach you. It was a very heavy emphasis on what you learned from anything, to the extent that if, let's say, a wasp flew into the classroom, then the teacher go, oh, you see, that's somebody who missed learning that particular bit of Jewish law in their life, and they've now come back to pick up on the bit they missed.
Okay, two things there. Firstly, biblical hero, very popular game on the kosher Xbox. And, you know, you can get a nice sort of like yard that you connect. It's a Bluetooth yard that you connect to your computer, and you have to make sure that you read the verse along in time with the computer screen. Secondly, your teacher there is invoking reincarnation, which do we believe in that?
We believe in kind of making up for the bit you missed. So it's not like you can come back. It's not like we were Cleopatra, unless Cleopatra missed that bit of Jewish law in her class. But you can come, you can sort of fix the bit of your soul that needs fixing. So, for example, if someone, this is a bit depressing, but if somebody dies very young or a baby passes away, then often the rabbinical explanation will be that they had a very tiny little job to do and they finished. So that's a good thing in a way. Not you should celebrate, but that you should think that they have completed their journey. So perhaps they brought the family closer together. Perhaps the family set up a charity in their name or whatever. So that's the sort of, that's the Jewish reincarnation.
I like the two things I like about that is one, it's an interpretation that you can apply to things like Red Dead Redemption or Grand Theft Auto. Clearly, rabbis look at the world like that, go like, well, you've only got it 99% complete. You've got one little side quest that you need to sort out, little baby. The other thing I love is this notion that, well, you've got to come back because you've missed your learning, that the entirety of the world. I mean, it's a very Jewish thing because we're all about the books and the learning. But I like the idea that kind of like you die and you go to the afterlife and God is like, did you do all the revision? And I'm like, oh man, I missed one class. Back you go as a wasp.
Wasps are Jews who were held back a year.
I used to truant a lot, so I'll be honest, I'm going to be back frequently, lengthily and often. That's what I reckon.
It also makes sense because, you know, wasps, universally hated / misunderstood.
Anti-Semitism for wasps. Anti-waspitism?
Anti-waspitism. And also, what you don't know is, like, we all know that if you go inside a beehive full of honey, no one knows what's inside a wasp's nest. I do. Gold.
Oh, dear, big.
There's so many gloriously odd characters and stories in the Old Testament. And I'm going to go to a classic to start off with, and a classic that I have mentioned on this podcast, and it is a chap called Balaam, who is a prophet. And he was sent by a chap called Balak, who was a midfielder for Germany in the early 2000s and also played for Chelsea. Real workhorse. And a hell of a right foot on him, though. Balak was also the king of the Moabites. And he told him to go and pronounce curses upon Israel. Off he went on his donkey to do that. God had other ideas and told Balaam to pronounce blessings upon Israel and not to return to Balak. Balaam disobeyed the Lord by returning to King Balak. Whilst riding his donkey, an angel confronted him with a huge fiery sword, and the donkey stopped in his path. At which point, Balaam foolishly went, "Keep going, donkey, keep going, donkey." And then God gave the donkey the gift of speech. And God is now facing a cease and desist letter from DreamWorks. But nevertheless, he did that. And the donkey said, "I ain't gone past there. There's an angel," because the donkey was being played by Mr. T. Balaam kept disobeying until the donkey pointed out to him that what had happened. But Balaam first thought that he'd gone mad and thought the donkey had gone mad. So he started beating his donkey. And the donkey said, "Why have you to beat me these three times?" Obviously, it's he beat a donkey, not an ass, because we want to keep it outside of the world of BDSM. It was only when the donkey said, "Why do you have to beat me three times?" was Balaam's eyes open to both the angel and God and his sin.
God loves a rule of three.
Yeah. Now, obviously, a Bible, much like David Attenborough's nature documentaries, full of sex and death, but there's bits of filth that from places that you wouldn't necessarily expect. King Solomon, he of the cleaving babies in twain, he wrote the Song of Solomon. A lot of it is about boobs. "He shall lie all night between my breasts, his left hand under my head, and his right doth embrace me." Which, by the way, that feels a lot like it's come straight out of Lay Lady Lay. "Thy young breasts are like two young roes that are twins, which feed among the lilies. Come, blow upon my garden, that the spices thereof may flow out. My beloved put his hands by the hole of the door, and my bowels were moved for him. Thy stature is like a palm tree, and thy breasts are clusters of grapes."
Is this how you propose to your wife?
What? Saying thy breasts are like clusters of grapes is like saying, what? I've got like 50 little mini breasts on each side.
What she needs to do is combine her breasts into one easy to manage breast.
"I will go up the palm tree and grasp the boughs. I am a wall and my breasts are as towers." I mean, what's fascinating with those? And that's an amended version of the Song of Solomon, condensed, so you get all the mammarilicious poetry. But it feels like it goes from real sort of GCSE English literature to a couple of really choice images, like "thy young breasts are like two young roes that are twins which feed among the lilies." That's solid stuff. But then also, "come blow upon my garden." Come on, Solomon.
Well, it's fascinating because, first of all, obviously, is that from Song of Songs? And clearly the inspiration for Shakira her hit. But also because King Solomon was he the father of King David or the son of King David?
Father,
I'm always a bit confused. Because, you know, there are all these questions about the sexuality of David when he was young. David and Jonathan, so King Saul's son Jonathan and David had a very close relationship that is described in quite floral language as well. And so it may be that there's, I don't want to be too psychological about things, but if Freud was reading it, I think he'd probably have a few things to say on the subject about an obsession with breasts if there's been a confusion about sexuality somewhere else in the family.
Yeah, how hot was Solomon's mother?
Oh, well, Solomon's mother was Bathsheba.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other story, because Bathsheba, David shagged Bathsheba while she was married to Uriah, behind Uriah's back, got her pregnant, and she was like, "Oh, I'm pregnant, you're going to have to do something." And so David got Uriah drunk and sent him out to fight in the front lines in a battle, so he got killed, so he could then, you know, marry Bathsheba, who was Solomon's mother. It's the sort of thing that it's like, but you know when you have like a child star, and David was like the version, the Bible version of a child star, he kings Solomon when he's a kid, he kills Goliath when he's a kid, and then he grows up like and he turns into a bad boy. He's like Justin Bieber or Charlotte Church, and gone off the rails.
Well, I was about to say, are you suggesting that King David is the Macaulay Culkin of the Bible?
Yes, I am.
He did a lot of the same tricks, didn't he, with slingshots and whatnot.
I mean, that... Yeah, so essentially the way Goliath was killed was not a slingshot, it was a paint tin swung off a balcony. But for my choice, there's a few others I could talk about, but maybe they might come up elsewhere. But for my choice, I'm going to go to the book of Genesis, and for a collection of shady characters who I would like to know more about, and that's sort of one of the reasons why I'm going to say that they are the worst, that there is a mystery about them and that they feel underwritten, but also because I cannot quite tell whether they be good, bad, or ambivalent, or where they came from, or what they're really doing in the Bible. What I am talking about is the Nehillim. As it says in Genesis 6:5, for those of you reading along at home, they were on the earth in those days, bit in, not specific enough, and also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. So they are an enormous mystery that have been debated about for centuries. Some people say that they are angels, perhaps fallen, that have come down into earth and made children with human women, and those children may have turned into a race of giants. Those race of giants may then have gone on to become the giants that lived in the land of Canaan, ruled over by King Og. Obviously, King Og being the progenitor of Nanny Og from Terry Pratchett's Discworld. And indeed, they may have been the progenitors of Goliath. Other people suggest that they may have just been another kind of being that lived in the pre-flood world. I want to make the suggestion that they might have been the Neanderthals. They may be prefiguring that. There are other people who have suggested they may have been a breed of superhumans that were wiped out after the flood. And of course, there are tin hat wearers who are going, aliens, definitely aliens. Definitely, definitely aliens. God essentially drops them in as an Easter egg and then pretty much forgets about them. But that's quite a large thing to stick in Genesis and then not mention almost anywhere else in the main Bible. What's your take on the Nephilim, Rachel?
So the obsession with the Nephilim seems to be much more of a Christian thing than a Jewish thing, funny enough. Okay. Like, and who they were. We've sort of accepted them as side characters and got on with it, really. I think for us, they're sort of, they are the people who begat the race of giants. They are considered to be fallen angels, but not like rebellious angels. So they weren't like bad. They just weren't, they just didn't buy into it, I think. And they weren't angel material. I was just remembering how I went to Brownies once and the brown owl said to my mum, I don't think she's brownie material. So I imagine if I was an angel, the same thing would have happened. So yeah, they're sort of fallen angels. They're not bad. They're not whatever, but they became this sort of race that did their own thing. And there's side characters that pop up, you know, now I'm picturing them as kind of Jar Jar Binks, which is quite surreal in my head.
See, I'm picturing them as in the first Avengers movies when they talk about, or no, it's not the Avengers movies, it's in Guardians of the Galaxy, where Benicio del Toro's character talks about the genesis of the Infinity Stones and about the world being ruled over by giant creatures. They're similar to the Titans in Greek mythology or the ice giants in Norse mythology. There are other world views that have other bigger creatures sharing the earth with humanity in our nascent stages.
I think that makes sense.
They have a longer appearance in the Book of Enoch, which is one of the Apocrypha, because they're in Genesis 6 as nearly like a bit from an earlier draft, it nearly feels like a side mention. And in the Book of Enoch, it has the story about them being also known as the Watchers, who snuck down to Earth and had sex with human women, and they had gigantic children, and they ended up eating all the food the people had and then trying to eat people. And so God, the suggestion is that God sent the flood to save humans from the Watchers rather than something else. So, but the thing I love about that though is God goes, listen, Noah, you got to build a boat. And Noah is what, in his like 300 or 400s at that point in terms of how old he is. He's like, I'm too old for this shit, God.
Please tell me that the Book of Enoch has a point where Noah goes, I'm gonna need a bigger boat.
Well, I think at the end the Watchers see their children are drowned, obviously, by the flood, and then the Watchers are imprisoned in the earth. And there's, I think, in various versions of the apocalypse, they come back as one of the things that happens at the end of the world.
Ah, right. Well, yeah, they're clearly malevolent or morally ambiguous. They, and I'm going to say, you know, a race of angels shagging humans, and this goes across all sorts of different theology and mythology, but that's essentially interspecies breeding, which I've got a line, guys. More that I'm frustrated because I want to know more. I know that the Bible's meant to be, well, it's meant to be about God and about us, and we're meant to be the stars of the show. By that I mean humans as well as Jews, but I feel like that there should be more about the Nephilim. It's like Arthur Conan Doyle dropping in an incredible character in the first chapter of The Hound of the Baskervilles, and then them just never coming back. It's an unresolved plot point. In the same way that Balaam's donkey is history's MacGuffin, I'd say that Nephilim are an unresolved plot point.
In early 2020, best friends Brian and Hoadley set out on a mission.
We are like 2,000 people away from getting 2,000 people to listen to this podcast.
The result? A mediocre comedy podcast.
So you're telling me there's a chance.
I'm telling you there's a chance.
A for effort, you two. A for effort.
It's a double rainbow!
The commercial break is available on all podcast providers. New episodes drop every Wednesday. Visit tcbpodcasts.com for more information. Tune it in and ride it out.
Shall I tell you who I discarded first? Because we had quite a lot of big family arguments about this. So our runners-up were, in no particular order, and please do not vote because the lines are now closed and money may be... But your vote may not count. So our runners-up were Moses, because he had a job he never asked for or wanted and wasn't particularly suited to. He was brought up in a palace and then he left it because he wanted to be sort of normal like everybody else. And he used to go meandering around the streets. So I imagine sort of trying to do a local accent like some kind of biblical Guy Ritchie. And he put up with such nonsense from Jewish people. I mean, anybody who's worked within their own community, whatever your community might be, for an extended period of time, you know like how much hassle it is. It's like major hassle. And he still made some stupid mistake that meant he didn't get into the land of Israel, which everything in his life was pointed towards this one final reward, and he never got it. So I feel like in a way he had it quite bad. We also had as a runner-up his brother Aaron, who was like always second in everything. That's tough, isn't it?
Yeah,
the support, I mean, just in terms of family dynamics, that's hard.
Aaron feels very much like the Michael Collins of the whole operation. You know, he's the one who doesn't get to walk on the moon.
I think of it more like brother in the cause. Because, you know, like in the cause, everyone remembers the three girls, don't they? And then, you know, there's the other one.
Jim.
We also rejected my own namesake, Rachel, or Rachel, who I've spoken about before in other things, in other shows. And basically, you know, she had quite a terrible life in lots of ways. I mean, she fell in love at first sight, but then she was jilted at the altar. She died in childbirth. Her name means sheep. Like, you know, so she had it quite tough. But the person that I chose is actually Esau, or in Hebrew, as he's known, Esav. And the reason I chose him is because he had all the skills to become like a hero and a leader of the Jewish people. But because he got hangry on one occasion, he messed it all up.
So Esau is Jacob's brother.
He is the brother of Jacob. They were twins. So these twins, Jacob and Esau, they have a lot of labelling from very early days. And to prepare for this conversation we were having, I not only did I read it in Hebrew and English, but also with commentary by Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, who's known as Rashi, who's a medieval French rabbi who's considered to have been the definitive commentator on analysing the language of the Torah. So, and he analysed it in the way that we do as stand-ups, like that we think of every word and how the different ways that could be construed and misconstrued, and how you can play with the language. And that is like mega in the story of Asav. I don't know how much depth you want me to go into here with this.
Go for it. No, because I'm sure many of our listeners won't know at least the bare bones of the story, let alone any of the details.
That's a good one, because the one thing that I remember about Esav, and it's interesting because this like obviously the relationship between brothers of Cain and Abel and Jacob and Esau and so many others throughout the Bible are key. But the only thing I remember about him is that he's described as being very hairy.
He is. In fact, I've always been a little bit surprised that your Hebrew name isn't Esav. But yeah, super.
Yeah, hairy. No. I am hairy by the standards of Gentiles. I am not hairy by the standards of Jews.
Their father was Isaac, slightly more famous Bible member, who was the son of Abraham, one of the top guys. Basically, Isaac is married to Rebecca, biblically, or Yitzchak and Rivka, as I was brought up with them. And she's been unable to produce a child. So he prays and she conceives in what we'd call in Take a Break magazine, a miracle baby. When I was reading this, I was thinking that back in the day, like, prayer was biblical IVF, wasn't it? And I guess in some parts of America still is. So he prayed, she has it, and it says actually that in the text that he prayed to God opposite his wife. And when I learned it as a child, it was that he was looking at her. But when I looked in the Rashi commentary, it had a very different explanation. It said Isaac prayed to God opposite his wife because she was barren, and the Lord accepted his prayer. And this is the way that Rashi super analyzed everything. He says that he accepted his prayer but not hers, because he was a righteous man, the son of a righteous man, and she was a religious woman, but the daughter of a very naughty boy. So I've paraphrased it slightly.
So they were having a they were having a prayer off.
A prayer off, and his prayer won. It doesn't really matter because it has the right outcome for both of them. I mean, in a British drama, it would be like an element of there's bad blood, and you wonder how much that beats into the story. So God says to her, there are two nations in your womb. There are two kingdoms that are going to separate from your innards. And one kingdom is going to become mightier than the other one. The elder is going to serve the young one. That is like a massive spoiler. I mean, and that's in the text. That's not an explanation. That's right there. A massive spoiler. That should not be allowed.
Yeah.
I mean, it shouldn't be allowed in anything. But I suppose it also sets up like parental expectation, which is very Jewish, because I remember when I was expecting my oldest child and people used to come up to me and like pat me on the stomach and go, oh, you got a little lawyer, have you? A little accountant, have you? So that's quite normal, that level of parental expectation for Jews.
I like that you've got twins. They're definitely going to found two nations.
Yeah.
Really high expectations.
But anyway, she, her days to give birth are completed, and she, behold, there were indeed twins in her womb. And the first one comes out, and he's described as being ruddy, and completely like a coat of hair, a coat of red hair, and they named him Esav.
So Esav's a ginger.
Esav is he's the first mentioned ginger.
Wow.
I was going to say, he comes out very hairy and ginger, so he's an orangutan.
Well, I mean, that would be one really offensive way of describing him that I'm sure all the children in his class... I mean, Esav sort of literally translates as something like fully made or completely made. So the idea was that he looked like an adult person virtually as a baby, which is quite creepy in a Benjamin Button kind of way. And I'd also say this is the first of his major skills for heroism, I think, in that he's a go-getter, right? He's the first to come out. He's ready to take on the world. He comes out ready to do his thing. That's impressive, isn't it?
It's all downhill from there, Esau.
Yeah, well, pretty much. Then his brother comes out and he's literally grabbing Esau's heel, and he's named Yaakov. Akev is the Hebrew word for a heel. So he's literally named after his action, which I think is quite dangerous for some of us. Like, I'd have to be called truant, probably. That's my most interesting action. So they grow up. And it said that Esav was a man who understood hunting. He was a man of the field. So that is his next skill, which is that he's a hunter, he's outdoorsy. Those are good talents to have, particularly now when you can meet with as many people as you want if you're a hunter and outdoorsy. Jacob, it says here, was an innocent man dwelling in tents. I don't think in a kind of Glastonbury way. He was just more bookish. I don't know if they had books then, but he was more parchmentish, I suppose. Again, there's a different perspective here, because Rushy says that he was someone who understood hunting, as in how to trap and deceive, which I think is quite mean in terms of how we feel about Esau. Like, being good at hunting doesn't necessarily mean you're a cruel person.
No, but it means he was more likely to vote Republican.
I always think this idea of one being a hunter, one being sort of into tents and religious study, makes it sound like they were both trying to do the Duke of Edinburgh Award between the two of them. There you go. Isaac, Yitzhak, loved Esav because his game was in his mouth. And there is a few interpretations from the Midrash, or fanfic as we now call it, of the Torah, whether that means the game as in he was good with language and he was open with his feelings, or whether he was good at being deceptive. This is interesting because it shows you there's favoritism. So Isaac loved Esau, but Rebecca loved Jacob. So you've got the two parents, you've got these twins, and they each have a favorite, and it feeds into the pathology of their family. This is like any TV show, really, because it's just about the editing, isn't it? We only hear the bit that we hear. Absolutely. So anyway, one day, Jacob has cooked what is called a pottage, but it's some kind of red lentil soup. Esav comes in from the field and he was faint with hunger, or as Rushy says, faint from committing murder of animals. So you can interpret that.
Wow, so Rushy clearly works for people for the ethical treatment of animals.
And I think we've all been hangry. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know about either. We've definitely all been hangry. So Esav says to Jacob, pour into me some of your lovely red soup, for I am faint. And from then on, actually, he's often known as Edom, which means red. So literally, because he had auburn hair and ate some lentil soup, he's now not only called Ginger, he's known as Red by everyone, which is harsh, I'd say. Harsh. But anyway, so that's what happens. Jacob says, okay, I'll give you the soup if you sell me your birthright.
And whoa! It's intense.
It gets very EastEnders at this stage, I'd say. And it's intense because it's not just your birthright as in money, it's status as well. But I don't think Esav was thinking about status, because they were twins doing their thing, living their best lives. And he was thinking more about like money and resources. And what did he need that for? He was a hunter, man. Like, he could go and do his thing. What did he need? What did he need the wealth of his father? So he says, look, I'm going to die anyway at some point. So fine, I don't need this birthright. Give me the soup. Jacob says, all right, swear to me this day. So he swears to him. He sells his birthright to Jacob. Jacob gives him bread. He gives him the lentil soup. He eats, he drinks, he gets up and leaves. And it says like Esav despised his birthright. I think he despised the idea of being a leader in a traditional sense, where he'd have to stop running about, you know, doing his thing. And he'd have to sit in a tent like his brother proclaiming stuff. We like proclaiming stuff, the three of us, but it's not everybody's thing. So
you turn your back for 1 minute and suddenly one of your kids has sold his birthright to his brother.
I mean, it's definitely happened in my house, but I've told them their only inheritance is about 2 million books, so I don't really care who has it. We'll have to build a shelter out of books if we got run over by a bus. So Esav by now is 40 years old. Time has passed.
And a teenager in biblical terms.
There was probably some kind of sequence with soft music and flashbacks of what happened in between. But he marries a couple of local women, which is a thing that people did. They were Hittite women. He settled down. And this sort of annoyed Isaac and Rebecca because he's married out of the faith. Although Judaism as a faith didn't kind of exist at the time. It was just monotheism in their family. But they got quite annoyed. And whose fault is that? They've been busy doing other... Did they ever say to him, don't marry out? That's not on him, I think, Esav. Comes to pass, Isaac gets old and his eyes are too dim to see. And he calls Esav, his older son, and he says to him, my son. And Esav immediately replies, here I am, which now you all know what the word is for that, Hineni. I think that's another brilliant skill. He's a prompt responder, isn't he? You call him and you need turns yeah. up, he's to fulfill your request. That is a properly amazing skill for a hero.
Yeah, Esav is killing it on LinkedIn.
totally. So Isaac says to him, behold, now I'm old. I don't know when I'm going to die. So sharpen your tools, your sword, your bow, whatnot, and go out to the field and hunt some game for me and make me the tasty foods I like and bring them to me and I'll eat them. And then my soul will bless you before I die. And Asaf is like thrilled to do this because another skill he has is respect for his parents. He's very obedient and he wants to make his dad happy. And clearly, also an excellent barbecuer and chef. And I can't really American Best Barbecuers or something on Netflix of that ilk. And it's not as easy as you think, actually, being good at barbecue. So that is another excellent skill for Asaf. But what happens is, meanwhile, is that Rebecca overhears Isaac saying this to Asaf, his son, and she sees Esau run out to go to the field to hunt game. And she calls in her favorite, Jacob. She says, I heard your father saying to Asaf to bring me game, bring me tasty foods. I'm going to bless you. And now, my son, listen to my voice. I am commanding you. So Isaac is like, please, do me a favor. Asaf's yes. Because Rebecca's like, listen to me and do what I say in that voice. Probably with her eyes, like I give the eyes to my kids when they don't do what I say. Their death eyes, as they call them to each other. So she says to him, I want you to go to the flock. Find me the best two kids, as in baby goats, not children. And I'm going to make delicious food for your dad like he likes. And you're going to take them to him and he's going to bless you instead. And Jacob said, like, this is not going to work because my brother Esau, as Ben has pointed out a number of times, is a hairy man. But I, Jacob, am a smooth man. And he says, perhaps my dad will touch me and it will appear to him like I'm deceiving him. It won't appear to him that he's deceiving. He is deceiving him, isn't he? This again is like he's Dean at Married at First Sight himself. I'll bring myself a curse and not a blessing. But his mother says, don't worry, I'll take the curse on me, which is very Jewish mother. Don't worry about anything. Let the curse be on me. Sit here in the dark, hating myself. But anyway, I'll take the curse on me. Listen to my voice. Do whatever I say. So off he went. He brings them to his mother. She makes him like delicious food. And then she takes Asaf's clothes that still smell of the field and puts them on him. She takes the hides of the skin and puts them on his hands and around his neck in, I guess, a Silence of the Lambs type fashion so that he now has hairy neck and hands. So she says, all right, take the food, go to your dad. So he goes to his father and he says, you know, my father. And Isaac says, here I am. And who are you, my son? And Jacob says, well, I'm Esau, your firstborn, and I've done exactly what you asked for me. Just like, come and sit down, eat my lovely food, and then your soul can bless me. And Isaac says, how did you get it so quickly? Because he's not an idiot, is he? How did you get it so quickly, my son? And he said, because the Lord your God helped me and prepared it before me. Classic. And then Isaac says, all right, come closer, my son. I want to feel you because I'm not sure if you're my son Asaf or not, but as he came nearer, could feel the goat skin on him. And he went, he says, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. That's quite dark. Yeah. He didn't recognize him, obviously, because his hands were hairy. So he blessed him. He said to him, just to check beforehand, are you indeed my son Esau? He just says, I am, because that's not lying, is it? Because he sort of, it implies he went, I am, but in his head went, Jacob, not Esau. Do you know what I mean?
Didn't finish his sentence.
Yes, but in your head, not yes. So he ate the food and he blessed him to become the leader, to take all the birthright, to have a big kingdom, that anyone who curses him will be cursed, anyone who blesses him will be blessed. When he finishes, Jacob leaves his father's presence. And at that moment, Esau comes back from the hunt. And he too had made tasty foods and he brings them to his father and he says to his father, come on, stand up, come and sit over here and eat this beautiful, delicious game and then your soul will bless me. And his father says, wait, who are you? And he said, I'm your son, your firstborn Esau. At this moment, it'll go, doof, 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 obviously.
I was going to say, that is the first ever double take in the Bible.
Yeah.
Almost definitely, and also would have been a really good spot for a season finale, I think, but we just carry right on. Isaac shudders, a great shudder. Who is this one who's hunted game and brought it to me? And the whole plan comes undone. Esau becomes very angry and he begs for one last blessing, and his father does give him a blessing, but it's just that his dwelling places will be the best places on the earth, and the dew of heaven will rain on him from above, and you will live by your sword, but you will still have to serve your brother. So he's given a sort of half-heartedly leftover blessing the scrapings off the bottom of the plate, which is a bit sad when clearly he is the better chef. But anyway, at that point, Esav hates his brother. He hates Jacob because of the blessing that his father's given him. And he says to himself, I'm going to let the mourning days of my father draw near and I will then kill my brother. And again, this is actually a kind of great skill and positive of Esav, because he respected that you need the 7 days of the Shiva, of the mourning period, to go up. You know, that's important. You go through the tradition. And then after that is when you kill someone. You don't do it during the Shiva. He had a lot of respect for his tradition, and I think that should be honoured in him. As soon as Rebecca hears this, then she sends Jacob away to live with her brother so that he's going to be safe. And I think she forgets that this is a situation that she and Isaac have created, this dissent between their children. They've caused it. Anyway, eventually, yeah, so Isaac does die. And after his death, and now what I want to do is tell you what I think is the biggest plot twist in this whole thing, and it's something I didn't know before researching for you. So this is what I thought was like the most unbelievable thing when I revisited this, which I've learned many, many times over the years, again, for you. And it is from the Midrash, which is the oral interpretation of the law handed down by word of mouth, which is why I call it fanfic, because some of it is probably historical stuff that happened and some of it is what if stuff and what could we learn from it if it happened this way, which is what kind of fanfic is. But anyway, so if we go right back to the beginning when the twins are born, if you could remember that far back, it was not quite before the pandemic, but it was a while ago. So before the twins were born, so if you remember, it was, and then his brother emerged grabbing Esav's heel, and he was named Yaakov, and that's what we had, right? You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
So if you read in the Midrashic interpretation, there is this, which I thought was quite interesting. It's big science. I hope you're ready for it. That Jacob held on to him lawfully to restrain him because Jacob was formed from the first drop of conception and Esav from the second drop of conception. Go forth. Are you listening? Because this is science. Go forth and learn from any tube that has a narrow opening. Insert two stones into it, one after the other. The one that entered first will always emerge last, and the one that entered last will always emerge first. So the result is that Esav, who was formed last, emerged first. And Jacob, who was formed first, emerged last. So Jacob tried to restrain him so he should be the first to be born, as he was the first to be formed, and he should have opened her womb and taken that birthright by law. He should have been the firstborn son all along. Plot twist.
I mean, the stuff about stones and tubes is bollocks, but... Wow! He's been done out of everything, and all along he should have been the first one.
There you go. What a fascinating little story that Jacob is like the anti-hero at the end of it, who should have always been the one born first because of the manner in which he was conceived. And if that isn't fact, I don't know what is.
Don't know if you know this, Ben. There's been a lot of Bibles published. Time magazine reckons that there's probably sales of over 5 billion copies of the Bible down through history. About 100 million are sold annually in the 2000s.
Wow, still not one each. Up your game, Gideons.
Yeah. And that in 2007, Time said it has done more to shape literature, history, entertainment and culture than any book ever written. That's probably true, in fairness. But then the question is, who wrote the Bible? And the New Testament writers, they explain the Old Testament in Timothy. He says, all scripture is given by inspiration of God. So that's how you get away with all of it. You go, well, if you don't agree with this, but you don't like that bit, God says it. It's all kind of God's work. So you have to go along with it. But there is studies on who has written different bits of the Bible. And I was particularly interested in the Pentateuch, which in the Christian religion, which I think is the Torah, is the first five books of the Bible.
Yeah,
the first five books of the Bible are said to have been written by Moses. They are not. It's plot twist, everybody. Not written by Moses, and there are various reasons that you can sort of dig around and why they were or won't. But lots of different bits of the Bible were written at different times, particularly the Old Testament. The first five books were probably all written by 500 BC, and then you've got some of the books of the prophets are written from then on, and you've got Daniel, which is written much later, and you've got...
Well, yeah, Daniel was written by Elton John.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. You've got Proverbs.
It was written by Simon and Garfunkel on a subway wall.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got Proverbs and Psalms are being constantly updated, maybe by about 200 BC, they're sort of intact. When Jesus refers to the scriptures in the New Testament, he basically is referencing most the Old Testament texts and the Apocrypha. They were sort of holy books for the Jews and Hebrews at this time. And the first, you know, Christian Bible, if you like, was compiled by St. Jerome in AD 400. He wrote the Vulgate, a Latin version of the Bible, where the Bible as we now know it, with all the chapters and books and verses as we would expect them to be, compiled around 400. But I was particularly interested, as I said, in the Pentateuch and who wrote this. And they all might be individuals or teams of scribes, but there are a few sort of distinct authors of different bits of the Torah, as you guys would call it. So the Elohist, or E, is one of these authors who's said to have been writing around 900 BC. They wrote a lot of Exodus, a bit of Numbers, and the earliest bit of the creation myth in Genesis.
I like the sound of this writing on an American sitcom.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a writer's room. Yeah, yeah. Elohist is called the Elohist because they refer to God as Elohim. So whenever God is referred to as Elohim, it's this particular writer's using it, and it's a quite a distinct word.
Yeah, well, Elohim is an old Cockney word meaning hello, male person. Elohim.
Yes. And the thing I like about that is Elohim is actually a plural. Elohim means gods. So the Elohist is writing about a polytheistic religion, which I really like.
Sorry, Rachel, you might correct me more on this, but I thought Elohim, it's plural because it's the many voices and many facets of the one God. Is that right?
Yes, and also, you know, nowadays we're very clear that they, them can refer to an individual.
Indeed, yes. All of these things are able to backsplain the early polytheism of Judea in about 1000 BC. But there were many polytheistic religions at the time, so it's one suggestion is it's just a hangover from the fact that you would refer to the gods as opposed to God as well. 600 BC, you get J, or Yahweh, which is the German for Yahweh. But as we know, it begins with an I, as Sean Connery taught us. No one really knows why God is called Yahweh. There's lots of different,
He's not.
Because it's spelt... Yud Hey Vav Hey, and that is how in Germanic pronunciation you would interpret it. But we don't ever use that word because it's considered a very holy word. So when Jews read those letter combinations, we pronounce it differently.
We say it as Adonai, don't we? This is the really weird thing, the whole Yahweh into Jehovah thing. It baffles me when I read in newspapers and academia everywhere the fact that the Yahweh thing comes up time and time again, and yet I was taught as a Jewish kid from like the age 3 that you don't pronounce it, it's pronounced Adonai. It feels like Judaism 101, and so many bits of the media and academia just ignore it or get it wrong. The Yahweh thing is just an absolute misnomer, and also because it's the Yud Hey Vav Hey is there instead of the Tetragrammaton, which is the 72 letter real name of God that only the angels can pronounce.
Yeah, the angels, and then I think maybe Aaron the secondary brother.
Essentially, God's real name is a small town in Wales.
Yeah. Well, I guess the thing is you've got so many different religions studying the same text that they all have their own different versions of what you can and can't do and different interpretations of it.
We call that lateral thinking, wouldn't we, when you all come out with your version of the same joke. Yeah. It's all fine. And my lot would definitely always stand by Moses wrote it before he died and it got passed on from generation to generation. And there are stories of the very early versions of the Torah being literally hand copied by people who then had the response. It was like a bit like a pyramid scheme that you'd copy it and then...
we've been involved in those before.
No, seriously. So yeah, you'd copy it, you'd find 10 other people to copy it. They'd each have to find 10 other people so that the exact wording would be maintained. And in fact, if you find like an actual Torah scroll, you find one, you know, in archaeology, an ancient one, you go to any other country in the world and look at one of theirs, old or new. I mean, the words are the same. Isn't so that's it? Quite a fascinating. And also because Jews are quite obsessive. So it makes sense as well. Of our inherent OCD.
Well, that's why the Dead Sea Scrolls are so fascinating, because they're the oldest intact copy of all of the. They've got every. The amazing thing is, like you say, every word is the same, and all the books are the same. They have every book of the Old Testament, apart from Esther, is in there. But the suggestion is maybe because Esther married a Persian, so that was a bit looked down upon.
Like, it's a big shot now, so it's all good.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, the reason I'm interested in Yahweh, which certainly in the Catholic and Christian church we would use the word Yahweh fairly freely, the thing I'm interested in that is they think the God that Yahweh was based on was a pre-Christian or pre-Judaic God, a storm and warrior God. So it's borrowing one of these gods from a polytheistic pantheon. But the really interesting thing I like about it is that it's referenced in a couple of other texts, and the etymology for the name of Yahweh is from a root HWY, which means literally he blows. Because he's a storm deity, but also you're going, this guy, he blows. So a hell of a statement. And he mentioned Moses being the author of the Torah. The one of the arguments against this is that another one of the authors of the Pentateuch is D is the Deuteronomist, which basically means the guy who wrote Deuteronomy, who was writing probably about 640 BC. And again, like all of these five books, it's attributed to Moses. But that's probably only possible if Moses would write in the third person and could see the future.
Because, well, I mean, if you're prepared to buy into everything else, then I think neither of those things are a big deal. And Deuteronomy is mainly like a recap, so it's like before the season finale, you're going back over everything that happened and who was connected to who, so that the people wouldn't forget in the interval.
It's basically that previously in the Bible, because and the thing about Deuteronomy is Moses knows where his own tomb is if he's the one who's writing it, which I very much enjoy. But yeah, Deuteronomy was written. The King Josiah of Judah he'd inherited his throne from his father at the age of 8. So he was trying to sort of solidify his claim to the throne. There were sort of like rumblings against him. So he said he'd found the Book of Deuteronomy under the floor of a temple which he was renovating. And he went, "Oh look, it's got this. It sort of matches all the ideals of the Cultural Revolution that I'm trying to lead at the time are basically enshrined in this holy book, which Moses definitely wrote." There are all sorts of different. It's if you read the different books of the Bible, the different periods of the Bible being written, and then look at what sort of the political history alongside it is as well. It's really interesting to see how they sort of match up and change with things. Right up to the New Testament, you get like the Book of the Apocalypse, and it's sort of tying in with the fall of Israel to the Romans and all of the stuff that's going on at the time. It's really interestingly thematically matching up. I want to talk briefly, but you mentioned Abraham earlier on, and God, Abraham has a rough old time of it. God makes him, you know, promise to remove his descendants' foreskins to remind them of the deal.
And his own with a sharp stone.
Yes, yeah. I like the fact that Abraham trains loads of people how to do this. That's a little detail which he gets overlooked in that. But God says everyone has to do this, and Abraham goes, and now I've got to do the admin of like hiring all these people and going, well, the job description is a bit weird, but bear with me. I imagine there'll be employment for millennia. not only that, Abraham begs God not to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he does. There's a really interesting like bargaining bit where Abraham begs God down. What if you find like 50 good people in Sodom, would you save? And God goes no, and Abraham goes 40, and God goes no, it's lower. He goes 30. He begs him all the way down to 10 people. He says, if they find 10 good men in the city of Sodom, will you save them? And God sends two people to Sodom to report on it. And I love this bit of the story. There's a riot of men outside the door of Lot's house where these guys are staying, Lot being Abraham's nephew. And all the men in Sodom are begging to shag these two messengers from God who's come to, basically like the inspectors, the health and safety inspectors. Yeah. And you know, the guys outside the door are like, no, we really want to sleep with these people. And Lotz offers his own daughters to sleep with them instead. And he goes, no, 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 we want the hot guys who we just saw walk in here not too long ago. And so that's enough for the God's messengers to go, no, yeah, you need to destroy this place.
I was just going to say, they were angels, these men. They were visiting angels. So I imagine they probably were quite good looking. I mean, they'd have been perfect, one assumes.
More on that in a sec. God, obviously, for people who don't know, God also gets Abraham. He says, Abraham, you got to kill your son, Isaac, who he prayed for years, as we've been over. Really wanted a kid for the longest time. And God goes, well, just to prove how devoted you are, I think you probably got to kill him. And makes him carry him. Abraham makes Isaac carry the wood on which he's going to be sacrificed for miles. And then it's only at the last second God goes, nah, here's a ram instead. You can sacrifice that. God's really giving Abraham a rough time. But at the end, in the Testament of Abraham, which is one of the Apocrypha, one of the books that's not in the Bible, God decides he's going to give Abraham a break. God says, you know what, Abraham? I'm going to give you heads up of when you're going to die. So God sends... And Abraham at this point is 995 years old. This book's not in the Bible, so he doesn't get to, you know, go to the top of the tree in terms of how old people are in the Bible. But in the Testament of Abraham, God sends the Archangel Michael to warn Abraham that he's about to die so he can get his affairs in order. Abraham is so nice to Michael that Michael goes back to God and goes, I can't kill this guy. Come on, can't we cut him some slack? And God goes, no, go down there and you tell that old man he's about to die. And Michael turns up again and Abraham goes, oh, hey, cool, I'm about to die. How about you show me all of creation, buying himself some time, clever. So Michael then takes Abraham all around Earth and all to the heavens and everywhere to show him what the entire of creation looks like. And eventually God sees us. He goes, you get back down there and you tell that man he's going to die. And Michael doesn't. So God goes, right, you're in detention for a week. I'm going to send Death instead. And Death appears as a beautiful, beautiful figure. As you mentioned, Rachel, angels look sexy AF. So Abraham tries to flirt. Abraham says, hail you of appearance and form like the sun, most glorious helper, bringer of light, wondrous man. From whence does your glory come to us? And who are you? And whence do you come? And Death basically goes, oh, I'm Death. Hi, nice to meet you. And Abraham goes, no, surely not. You're too sexy to be Death. And Death is like, no, I'm Death. And Abraham goes, no, you're not. I'm going to have a lie down on a sofa. And so just walks away. Death follows him and sits at the end of the sofa. And Abraham's like, oh, Death, I'm trying to have a nap. And Death goes, no, I'm here to take you. He goes, no, you're not sexy, Death. And Abraham goes, I'm going to have a lie down in bed now. And Abraham goes to bed and Death follows him again. Because, no, it really is time for you to die. And Abraham says, no, I don't believe you're Death. If you're really Death, why don't you look ridiculously horrible? And so Death goes, all right then, and reveals his horrific visage, which kills 7,000 people in the vicinity. But not Abraham. Abraham's like, wow, you've got 7 serpent heads and 14 faces. And these faces are all like flaming fire and a face of darkness and the face of a snake and the face of a sword and the face of a lion. And Abraham, Death's like, okay, you see, I'm Death. We're going to heaven now. And Abraham goes, no, before we do that, explain to me all of these faces. And so Death, basically, I think at this point, the author of this book forgets how metaphor works and goes, well, the face of fire I showed you is because many died consumed by fire. The face of the precipice I showed you because many men died descending from the tops of trees. The face of the sword I showed you because many are slain in wars by the sword. And basically he goes, so the bit that's a snake is because snakes kill people. And the bit that's poison is because poison kills people. It's the most like on the nose. It's the most on the nose bit of writing you've ever seen. And Death goes, okay, now we've been through all of this. We really have to go now. And Abraham goes, oh, I'm feeling tired. Can you just like leave me for a little bit longer? And Death goes, I know what I'll do. Kiss my hand. It'll make you feel better. And Abraham kisses Death's hand and dies.
I mean, This is amazing. It sounds like speed dating, where one of the couple like really is clinging on.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how many times that buzzer goes off. They want to stick with a person who's been randomly allocated to them.
Yeah.
Amazing.
But I love how like Abraham is just playing the longest like drawn out game of like catch me the whole way through that story. But Abraham isn't my choice. Death isn't my choice. God is my choice for the world's worst Old Testament character. The Old Testament God. For all of we've already discussed, he's making, you know, unreasonable expectations of people. He's sending a flood which wipes out humanity. We all know the arguments that God is capricious and all of these things. And the Bible goes out of its way. The Old Testament goes out of its way to address this. We get the book of Job. And basically, the book of Job addresses the whole idea of, like, how can there be a just God when human beings suffer? And it's a really good book. It's really well written. Alfred Lord Tennyson called it the greatest poem of ancient and modern times.
5 stars, The Scotsman.
And the whole premise of it is that Job is, you know, he complains about how terrible God is to loads of his friends, and then God comes and explains why to him. But the premise of it is that God has made a bet with Satan. The Lord says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He shall persist. He still persists in his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him for no reason." So God has got, the devil has made God be mean to Job for the point of a bet, just to see if Job would like turn against God. And God's like, "Nah, look at Job. He still loves me." And Job does spend the whole book being, you know, saying how can God be just and all of the terrible things that have happened to me. And God appears and does the longest "Do you know who I am?" speech you have ever read. I really encourage anyone to go and read Job chapters 38 to 41, because Jesus, God goes on a lot. God comes in strong with, "Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation?" And going, "I'm the guy who created the world. What were you doing? Oh, right, you didn't exist yet. Why is that? Because of me." He goes, "Have you given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? Do you hunt the prey for the lioness and satisfy the hunger of the lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in a thicket? And by the way, Job, what is the way to the abode of light? And where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths of their dwellings? Surely you know, for you were already born. You've lived so many years." God is so passag in the entire book of Job. It's the most sarcastic you've ever heard a deity be.
I'll be honest, this is exactly what I use when I want to get a table in a kosher restaurant that's quite full.
He takes credit for ostriches, for wild donkeys being wild, for giving the horse its mane, for the birds that can fly, all of this stuff. And then Job interrupts and he goes, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more." And God comes right back with another 2 chapters. He goes, "Brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's?" Basically going, "Do you even lift, bro?" and then does an entire chapter of boasting about how he made the Leviathan and then has captured the Leviathan. It's for all of the things God does, and we could talk about how, and there are lots of things in the Apocrypha about what happens to, you know, aborted fetuses and all of these things that are horrific. There's the way he treats lots of the characters, the way he treated Abraham, the way he treats Noah, the way he treats, you know, Samson, all sorts of characters. And then, but we just get, he's got all these powers. We know all this stuff about him. And his response to a guy who's like, "Why are you like this, God?" is like, "I don't have to answer this. I'm God."
Which is what you would say if you were God.
Yes. But yeah. In I think over the course of 4 chapters, in a really sarcastic voice, slightly demeans the you know, the inherent deity.
The office.
Yeah. Yes. It's like a Trump tweet. It's like a Trump thread.
I mean, it would be incredibly off-brand for me to in any way take part in that conversation. And I'd be quite worried about being smitten by a bolt of lightning or something if I was in any way agree with you. I mean, it's a tough call. I have quite a close personal relationship with God, and I'll have to have the conversation and then come back to you on that one.
Well, lucky for you, you're not the judge this week. I am.
Absolutely. Yeah, lucky for Rachel, God is the judge, so you're in a lot of trouble.
The thing is,
now, when we're coming up to Yom Kippur.
Mm. Well, the thing
is... yeah. That's a really good point, Rachel. Listen, I am a really bad Jew, but I'm not sure I want to be part of a podcast that calls God the worst character in the Old Testament a few days before Yom Kippur.
The thing is, as well, though, if I were to pick God, I'd be the one who'd have to be on the end of a yak, four chapters long explanation of why he's better than me. And he also wrote the book, so he's written himself into it. He's written himself this way, and I don't want to give him the pleasure of acknowledging his own, like, I've written this book and it's semi-autobiographical. It's not really about me. It's sort of inspired by my experiences vibe. So I'm not going to pick the Old Testament God, much and all as I would like to, because I don't know. We might lose a few listeners. I don't want to risk it. I'm craving that way. And I'd quite like to, I don't think I'm going to pick Esau either.
Okay.
Because, like you said, he's sort of, he's not a bad guy. He's sort of been done out of it by everyone else around. His family has kind of messed it up for him in a way. And he seems like quite a likable, accomplished figure. Who his entire... You can't pick your family. They just, you know, they've conspired against him to demean him in so many ways.
He's his mate.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think, Ben, because, you know, they were possibly human-eating giants and the offspring and the offsprings of angels raping human women. I think I'm gonna pick. Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe they enjoyed it. Maybe not. But I think I'm gonna pick the Nephilim. So congratulations to you, and I look forward to the spin-off that we're gonna get, written by you, especially to tell us what happened to them once they got. Tell us about their journey trying to escape from being trapped in Earth. Congratulations, and phew, bullet dodged. Yeah. I can just hear someone. I could just hear a lightning bolt being diffused somewhere above my head. Before we go, I've got to give some of the world's best news of the week, which we're continuing to do during the pandemic. And this is a follow-on from some of our good news a couple of months ago, where we talked about the statue of slaver Edward Colston being ripped down in Bristol. And the news is that there's going to be a new name for the Bristol venue, the Colston Hall, which for a long time has been the subject of protest over its name and its association with him. It's a performing arts venue in Bristol. It is no longer to be known as the Colston Hall. It'll now be known as the Bristol Beacon. It's nice to see the tipex of history being carefully used in a very positive way, and let it be a beacon for more positive results of the Black Lives Matter protests that have been happening recently. The process apparently had begun 3 years ago. It's not a terribly recent one, but it included the Bristol band Massive Attack refused to perform at the venue unless the name was changed. So finally, it only took 3 years for people to change the sign on the outside of it, but there we go, finally it's happening. Before we go, Rachel, where can people find out more about you and your work and what you're up to at the moment?
You can find me on my website, rachelkrieger.com. I'm on social media at Rach Krieger, and also my lovely podcast with comedian Philip Simon, Jew Talking to Me. We're at Jew Talking without the G on everything. And we just finished series one. We're about to start series two, and we have some stonkingly amazing celebrity type guests talking about their lives and how much Jewishness has or hasn't played a part, mainly related to food, is what I'd say. give us a follow on Spotify or iTunes, wherever you get your podcast, Jew Talking to Me.
I mean, my experience of Judaism through Ben is largely based around food as well, so I am wholeheartedly endorsing that. Meanwhile, we're all off to whip Ben's ass to see if it speaks to us. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye.